Today's episode is from my training session with Shay Rowbottom's Heal Tribe, and we are going to discuss how to identify when you are accelerating in the wrong directions. That's right, you got to stop, drop, and roll. Tweet me at David Meltzer, your favorite takeaway. Ask me any questions live every Friday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. Remember, you can join my text community at 949-298-2905 or always email me, david@dmeltzer.com. This is Entrepreneurs the Playbook.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this journey?
Oh, thank you so much, Shay, and appreciate being here. I see some friends out there, so thank you for having me. Hopefully I won't bore you with my journey. But my journey of healing started at 5 years old, really. And I grew up in Akron, Ohio, with a single mom, six kids, a mom who worked two jobs just to support us with food and clothes. Packed our dinners in paper bags to work those two jobs and put us in a station wagon to study. She believed the fetus wasn't fully developed till after graduate school. Had her favorite saying, doctor, lawyer, failure. And for me, my journey started with the understanding and relationship to one of my favorite energies, one of my favorite currencies. It's an object of energy that I put into the flow to get what I want daily, and it's called money. And I had a very interesting relationship with money when I started, because I didn't want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a failure. I just wanted to be rich. And the reason I wanted to be rich is later on in life, I found that I was born with a quantum nature to be happy, which is a huge advantage. I have extraordinary potential in my life because I have a happy gene, a programmatic way of looking at things with light lessons and love in mind. But even though I was happy as a five-year-old, the only time I wasn't when I was scared or in ego-based consciousness was when I catch my mom crying. My mom would cry because of financial stress. She'd cry if the car broke down or the dishwasher or couldn't afford summer camp or was concerned about education or clothes or food. And so in my mind, I'm like, man, money buys happiness. I'm going to buy my mom happiness. I'm going to buy her a house. I'm going to buy her a car that works. And everything in my life is going to be perfect. And so that relationship with money kept me into what I call the mathematical equation of luck, is that I, no matter what in my life, no matter what I wanted to do as a child, as a teenager, as a college student, as a graduate student, I was always paying attention to and giving intention to the coincidence of being rich, right? Attention plus intention equals the coincidences that we want in our life. I call it the mathematical equation of luck. And this was all subconscious. This was not something that I purposefully, strategically laid out at 5 years old or 10 or 15 or 25. But I was able to, when I graduated law school, 9 months out of law school, become a millionaire. And I bought my mom the house and the car. And unfortunately for me, everything I did from that point on reaffirmed my relationship with that currency, with that object of energy. I went from living in a world of not enough, a scarce world where I was a victim. I'd ask my mom, why me? Why us? Why don't we have this? Why do they? Why? And I had moved into this attitude of a world of just enough for me. So things went from happening to me into a world where things happened for me. And I thought I was an optimist. I would give so I could receive. Everything was a trade and negotiation. It's still, though, as I look back and connect the dots backwards, was a scarce world. Even though I was philanthropic and abundant and successful and all of these other things, I still lived in this world of just enough for me, which meant I had to buy things. I had to utilize the currency of money to buy things to be happy. If I wasn't happy, I'd buy different things. If I wasn't happy, I'd buy more things. If I wasn't happy, I'd buy things I didn't need. If I wasn't happy, I'd buy things to impress people, especially people I didn't even like or didn't even know. And that world was a scarce world. And everything I did, I worked for a company, I sold legal research online, became a millionaire. We sold that company in 1995. For $3.4 billion, reaffirming money buys love and happiness. I went to the Silicon Valley. I raised hundreds of millions of dollars in my 20s. I ended up being the CEO of the world's first smartphone, a Windows CE device, working with Microsoft and Samsung. And all from Good Morning America, speaking around the world. I married my dream girl, the girl that skateboarded by my house in the fourth grade that my best friend Rob asked her to go study with me at sixth grade camp and embarrassed me and said, dude, she said no. And because I didn't ask her myself, so I threw an egg at her. Everything in my life, my whole definition was defined by how much money I had, because money bought me love and happiness. And then I realized that it was much more than that, that it wasn't the currency of money that dictated my happiness. It wasn't that money could buy happiness and love. It was that money allowed me to shop. And what I mean by that, it allowed me to leverage not what surrounded me, but what surrounded me, that there was a much more powerful currency that complemented or blended the money in this pragmatic world that I lived in. And that currency is called faith. That currency is an object of energy that I put into the flow to get what I want, that surrounds what surrounds me. And I had to experience pain in order to learn this lesson, by the way. I tell people all the time that pain is not a stop sign. Pain is an indicator. It's a turn signal. It's always telling me, hey, you got a lesson to learn. Turn in this direction to learn it. And when you do, you'll be in a better place, a better situation, or your situation will be better. And that philosophy, understanding that pain, you know, pain, mental, physical, spiritual, financial, emotional pain, it didn't matter, was just an indicator. It was a turn signal. It wasn't a stop sign. It wasn't a failure. It wasn't even a mistake. It was simply an indicator that I had a lesson to learn. And I had some lessons to learn. I learned those lessons 2 years before I lost everything over $100 million. I had a lesson to learn, and it was called radical humility. And that humility came from the understanding that I did not know what I did not know. And I've forgotten the two of the basic rules. I had forgotten gratitude, forgiveness, accountability, and inspiration, what got me there. But I joke around, the two things that I really forgot I learned before I was 3 years old. One of my favorite books is Everything You Ever Learned, Anything You Ever Need to Learn was in kindergarten. But I think it happened before. The number one thing was just plain gratitude. If you want to change your life, take 0.1 seconds at night and 0.1 seconds in the morning and just say thank you. If you say thank you for 30 straight days before you go to bed and when you wake up, I promise you, I guarantee you, that your life will change for the better. It'll continually change for the better because you now will live with the perception of finding the light, the love, and the lessons in everything. You will realize how great it is. And here's the greatest thing. I will tell you with everyone that'll watch this, that by tonight, half of you won't say thank you. By tomorrow morning, another half won't say thank you. Within 3 days, almost all of us will stop saying thank you. I forget to be grateful at times, and I teach this stuff multiple times, multiple days, every single day, and still, it's how quickly do I remember to say thank you. Yet, I have surrounded myself with the biggest thought leaders in the world. Deepak Chopra, unbelievable people like Bob Proctor, just extraordinary millionaires, multimillionaires, billionaires, entrepreneurs, celebrities, athletes, entertainers. Everybody agrees gratitude is the most powerful thing in the world. In fact, I've studied physics, quantum physics, and metaphysics myself, and I will guarantee you it's the most powerful thing. But why is it we all forget? And then the second thing that I learned in most powerful and radical humility, you know, when you're little, your grandma, your mom, your aunts, uncles, they say, don't forget to say thank you. But what's the other thing they say when you're 3 years old? Don't forget to ask. You need to ask, honey. I think the greatest power of humility is asking. You cannot out ask the universe. If you want to utilize the currency of faith, then you've got to learn that we live as an instant between limitlessness and infinity, that we can't even out ask the universe. And yet most of us, as much as we don't say thank you and forget that, we don't ask. And there's only two series of questions to ask. Number one, how can I be of service or value to you? How can I be of service or value to others? And more importantly than that, because I shifted my paradigm from giving to receive as a trader in negotiation, the bigger question is, do you know anyone that can help me? True radical humility comes from a place of receiving so that you can give. And I shifted my paradigm so that I focus my attention and intention on the coincidences of receiving with complete confidence in faith that it's going to come through me with appreciation, not only gratitude, but with all of the values that I have to come through me for others. I no longer live in the world of to me as a victim, why me, or even try me, where things come for me, buying things I don't need to impress people I don't like. Everything in my life comes through me for others. And this is what happens when you live that expansive, accelerating life, is your life may be full, but if you keep expanding, it creates a vacuum, right? If this was full, it's going to create a vacuum. And we have to be mentally disciplined to put into the vacuum what we want. And that's why asking and appreciation are so important, because most people, what they do is they put what they don't want in the vacuum, or they put what other people want in the vacuum. You need to learn what you want to put into that vacuum. And if you do so, you'll help me with my mission of empowering over a billion people to be happy by empowering you to empower others, to empower others simply to be happy, utilizing this understanding of currency. The objects of energy that we put into the flow to get what we want, not what other people want, not what we don't want, but money and faith, the two currencies that allow us to do that.
Wow. Trevor, where's your mic? He's got a mic that he, there we go. He does the mic drop thing. Thank you. Thank you, David. I just want to honor you on your journey to self-actualization and everything you've been through. I myself just still can't fathom losing 100 million and what that would do, and the sort of strength it would take to pull out of that, not being a victim. So we have a question here, and I think it's an important one, because I think a lot of people here can relate to that place of feeling hopeless, of feeling like, I just need to be a taker. I need to protect myself. That ego consciousness you mentioned, like, I'm only going to give because I want something in return here, and not truly operating from heart and not having faith. So Trevor asked, what was the moment that you added faith, and was there a life moment or something specific that brought that into your life? That would, like, what was kind of the catalyst for, like, the shift for you, where you stepped out of that victim consciousness and started to empower yourself with faith?
There's two things. One, when I lost everything, I was already on a journey living with gratitude, forgiveness, accountability, and inspiration. I talk about a jacket that my father gave me, and I came to the realization that I hated my father because I hated myself, that I was a liar, a cheater, manipulator, overseller, and backend seller. But when I lost everything, I was terrified that, number one, Lee Steinberg, the most notable sports agent in the world, would fire me because he hired me to be his Midas, to tell the athletes and celebrities, hey, our CEO is Midas. He's going to take care of the number one thing you're afraid of, which is your financial stability. And I thought, how the heck am I going to be the CEO of the most notable sports agency as a bankrupt loser? And yet he never did anything except for support me. But even moreover, when I went bankrupt, I realized one awful thing. I had forgotten. You talk about imagining losing $100 million. That didn't bother me because I'd always made money. It's quantum in my nature. I made money when I didn't know anyone, I didn't know anything, and I never had a job, and all I had was law loans. Like, if I could make money again knowing what I knew now. But what really sucked was I realized when I lost everything that I forgot to take my mom's house out of my name, which meant the only reason I ever wanted to be rich was to buy my mom a house. And I had to go to her and tell her, not only doctor, lawyer, failure, that I had lost everything, but she was going to have to move. And in my mind, that was going to be it for my mom. In my mind, because money buys love and happiness, even though I was living with gratitude and forgiveness and the things that my mom taught me, I still hadn't crossed over into this abundant world, and I didn't understand. In fact, my wife and my mom, who will be brought up in this story, they kept telling me my whole career that I was lost. And I'd look at them and go, look around you. Who has a Ferrari? I'm lost. Who owns a golf course? I'm lost. You make 12 grand a year and you're going to tell me I'm lost, right? And so now I was completely lost and humbled to go tell my mom, and mostly worried for her. And I get to her door and she opens it up, and I started just to cry. I couldn't even talk, and I finally get the words out. She's like, what's the matter? I was like, Mom, I lost everything. I'm bankrupt. I'm so sorry, but I forgot to take your house out of my name. I lost your house. You're going to have to move. She just looked at me and smiling said, are you okay? Do you need any money? I was like, are you kidding me? Like for me, I understood at that time, my mom, she understood way more than I did. And although I was born with quantum gifts, happy genes, the money gene, all of these things, that she truly understood giving unconditionally, without wavering, with no concern of herself. So that changed my perspective. Then, sorry, my wife, I kept my job. We lost everything. We went from a home that was incredible, 33 homes I owned in total, a golf course, I owned a ski mountain, to a rented home with rented furniture, one car, three daughters under 10 years old, and my wife was pregnant with our fourth child, which was going to be a boy. So I came home with my first paycheck, and I asked my wife, I'd gone through this transformation, I'd asked my wife, would it be okay? My wife and I grew up together, as I said. We went to the same high school. I said, would it be okay if I gave money for a kid to get a scholarship to college from our high school? I never would have went to college but for a scholarship. My siblings never would have went to all the Ivy Leagues without a scholarship. I want to give this away. And without blinking, my wife said, in tears, oh my gosh, you get it. I was like, I get what? She goes, you trust the universe. I go, I do. I go, I really trust the universe. Is this okay? She goes, yeah, but double it. I looked at her and I'm like, I don't trust the universe that much, which will still show you that I'm on a journey of practice and blending currency with faith, because she has far more faith in me and in the universe than I have and still have in myself. But those two things were extraordinary lessons, painful, extraordinary lessons that changed my trajectory, that allowed me to be more interested and interesting in the things that I want to do to help others come through me. I realized that it was a connection always that I had, and I just had to use my free will to clear that connection, to create less corrosion between me and this great source of abundance, of infinity, of everything for everyone, and allow it to come through me with appreciation for everything else that I'm connected to, and use my free will to clear those connections, usually created by fear-based, ego-based consciousness, primary and secondary ego-based consciousness, needs to be right, offended, separate, inferior, superior, anxious, frustrated, guilty, resentful, all of those different things that send us and accelerate us in the wrong direction.
Well said. Well said. Yes. So that's, I think, a really good place to pivot because of what's actually going on collectively in the world right now, David. We're starting to really see a lot more of that polarization between like the ego, I need to be right, you know, my view is better than your view. If you don't believe what I believe, you're canceled, you know, and that this whole culture, I mean, it's been that way, I'd say, for a while, but I feel like 2020 has exposed it, right? Has like really like blown the lid off of how reactive people are and how much people are in their egos and need to be right. What can you say from your perspective and all the experiences you've had, what can you say about the current state of the world and what we can do as individuals to help heal the collective and where this is all going to shake out?
You get what you seek. You know, not only do you get what you ask for, we get what we seek. And unfortunately right now, people are seeking what's different about us. They're seeking a separation. Instead of, I always say in sales, make yourself equal and then appreciate the differences. Make yourself equal to a competitor and appreciate the differences. That one thing, if we all sought what we wanted from other people, if we look for the superpowers in one another and then appreciated the difference and learned about the weaknesses in others, and instead of segregating out and separating those weaknesses, taking the weaknesses and moving them to a different place. Remember, every weakness that exists, move to a different place is a strength. And every strength, move to a different place is a weakness. And what we need to do is seek what we want from others. You know, I tell a basic story about my own wife when I used to come home late from Orange County driving home, and I'd say, oh, my wife's going to be so mad at me. She's not going to understand. She's going to be so upset. She's going to yell at me. I'm missing dinner, blah, blah, blah. That's exactly what I got. But when I started saying to myself, I'm so blessed to have such an understanding wife who appreciates that I'm staying late to provide for the family and provide, that's exactly what I got. And right now, you know, we are looking to be separate. We're looking for the differences. We're seeking inferiority and superiority. We're seeking it instead of seeking where we are the same, how we can take our strengths and move them and help others where those are weaknesses for them, and how we can move their weaknesses and make them strengths. This is just basic physics to me. And so what I'm trying to do is empower other people to find their superpowers and look for the superpowers in others.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love how you mentioned it's just basic physics to you, because it is science, like manifestation. It's real. Wherever we put our attention and our energy, that's what will grow. So the more that we put our attention and energy on, you know, worry, on feeling wronged, feeling like a victim, we're just going to manifest more of that. But something I would like your opinion on, and this is something that I myself actually still struggle with and have been working on, is actually getting caught in the worry trap. And then knowing everything that I know about healing now, I actually get this like dose of guilt, because I'm like, Shay, you're not supposed to be worrying. Now you're going to manifest that. Like, stop worrying, Shay, stop worrying. But then I'm like worried that I can't stop worrying, and I keep going. So do you have any thoughts about, yeah, it's right. It's like too much self-awareness. Any advice on how to actually like stop it? Like, if someone in this group, for example, is knows that they're prone to high anxiety, knows that they tend to worry about the worst case scenario, but now they're aware of this information of, oh no, the more I worry about it, the more it'll become real, but they still can't get out of it. What tips do you have there?
Well, first of all, you know, the conscious, subconscious, and unconscious mind work in a continuum. And that's why we have to be consistent in what we do. And is why physics and math and technology and practice and strategy are so important to me, even though I'm probably more of a higher vibrating frequency spiritual being than I ever have been or than a lot of people. But I'm very pragmatic in the utilization, knowing what vibration I live at. So what I've created is an avatar of myself called the Ferocious Buddha. And what a Ferocious Buddha does is four things when we're accelerating in the wrong trajectory. One, we have to practice identifying what sends us into an accelerated trajectory that we don't want. So in order to do that, number one, we got to know our values. So one of the practices that we should all have is to take inventory of our values, our personal values, some of our non-negotiables, our experiential values each day. What do we want to experience from the day? Our giving values of how we want to provide value to others. And of course, importantly, the receiving values. What do I want? Not the why, the what do I want? And utilize not only a weighted balance of those values, but also don't be afraid of being a hypocrite. Changing your mind every day. Learning and loving and accelerating and saying, you know what I didn't know when I was 17. I know differently now, and I know that I'll know differently when I'm 27, 37, or 47. When you take inventory of your values, it allows you to identify those needs of the ego, the need to worry, the need for guilt, the need for resentment or offense or separation, inferiority, the need to be unworthy, all of these needs. So what does a Ferocious Buddha do? One, raises their awareness like a Buddha to identify when we're in the wrong trajectory, when we're accelerating in the wrong trajectory. And then the Ferocious Buddha stops. You said it while you were explaining it. Subconsciously, you said, stop. Yes, stop. If you're moving, if you're going 80 miles an hour the wrong way on the freeway, I promise you the first thing you would do is pull over and go the other way. You would stop. You'd stop moving in the wrong direction. But for some reason, even those who can identify, like you, Shay, that you're moving in the wrong direction with guilt and worry and ego-based emotions, we don't stop. We think somehow we can course correct when we're moving 80 in the wrong direction. No, no, stop. And it's, you have to be ferocious. Sometimes I have been blessed over the last 10, I'm married 23 years. The last 10 years of my marriage, I probably have had three accelerated trajectories I didn't want to be on, arguing with my wife with a stupid need, probably fueled by anger. If any of you have ever experienced that, that's usually some physical manifestation of why I'm moving in the wrong trajectory. But the last time I did it was over nothing. And I ended up screaming at my wife. And while I'm screaming at my wife, over nothing, by the way, I am talking to myself in my head, did you just say that? Shut the F up. You're an idiot. No, you just said that? Holy, are you kidding me? I'm sitting there so out of control in the wrong trajectory while I'm having a Buddha conversation in my thing. And my Buddha's telling me, stop. Stop. Oh no, you did not. She just swore at you. Oh yeah. You know, and I'm going and I'm getting madder and I'm like, whoa, finally, I got ferocious enough to stop. I identified my needs of the ego and I stopped. And that's when this third step. So identify, stop, which takes the ferocious, then be a true Buddha. Once you get yourself to stop, breathe, find your center, find neutrality, find your higher self. Your highest frequency, allow yourself to clear all of the corrosion and interference to that pure potential, truth, love, and light, and lessons that exist in there. Find the gratitude and peace and accountability right there. You're always connected to it. You have as much power to light up an entire city within you because you're always, so go ahead, clear it away. And we do that really by breathing. Breathe through your nose, past your eyes, out through your mouth to the end of the universe. I take what I call the six breaths of Buddha. And if that doesn't work, I take six more breaths of Buddha until it works. But eventually, usually now in minutes and moments, not days, weeks, months, and years like it used to take me. And I'm telling you, there is something, some needs of mine, like the need to be resentful, offended, and right, that I spent years in the ego-based consciousness accelerating in the wrong direction. Now it's minutes or moments. I breathe, and then once again, I put into effect the law of Goya, get off your ass and roll in the right direction. Go ahead, turn around and move the freeway the other way, pick up momentum, compound interest, aggregation, acceleration, 80 miles an hour in the right direction. So whenever we can utilize the ferocious Buddha to identify, stop, drop, and roll, you will save yourself so much time, money, emotion, and energy and resources. If you go back in your life and just look at worry alone, how much time, emotion, energy, money, and resources that you've wasted in your life worrying, you would guarantee double the amount of money that you have, double the amount of friends that you have, double the amount of things that you were able to help other people with simply by stop, dropping, and rolling. Remember, when you're an ego-based consciousness, your mind, body, and soul are on fire. Everybody knows when you catch on fire, you got to stop, drop, and roll. So go ahead, identify when you're on fire, stop, drop, and roll. And you will have an extraordinary amount of abundance and acceleration and growth in your life.
That's so beautiful. I love what you said about just the amount of energy over time that goes into worrying. I want to touch on a couple of things you said, which is like, you know, at the end of the day, healing, it never ends. Like it never ends. So just as David said, even though he has this Buddha practice, he can recognize it in himself, it will still happen where the ego will pop in. It's just now he has the tools to address it right away. So not making yourself wrong for still feeling it, like, oh, why do I still have this guilt? Oh, why do I still have this ego? It's like, well, you're human, you know, like now you have the tools to course correct, to know not to go down that path. And that's the important thing. And the other thing is, one of my life coaches said this to me, which I think you'll love, David, is he said, think about all the time you spend like worrying about a future event. Like, okay, let's say for example, you got like a speaking engagement, you're like super worried and you're nervous and you're spending all this energy worrying about all the bad things that could happen. He said, at the end of the day, you don't actually know what could be the outcome of that event. Why would you waste your energy worrying why not spend all of that energy excited about the best case scenario? Because either way, you don't know. You're right. You could totally like poop your pants on stage. It's the worst thing ever. But you could also give the speech of your life and get tons of business and meet your soulmate and have all these connections. So like, why worry? Why imagine the worst case when also the best case can happen and you could spend your energy not worrying, but excited for the best case? And that has really supported me when I start worrying. I'm like, why don't I get excited about this? So just another tip that's supported.
Can I add to that as well?
Yes, yeah.
The next step that I take in that is one of my favorite words, which is practice. And my kids will tell me, I spoke in Sydney at the theater and there were 70,000 people in the stadium and it came off in Australia. And my kids were like, weren't you nervous? And I said, next time, why don't you come on stage with me and I'm just going to ask you to clap once. Would you be nervous if I asked you to come on stage and just clap and leave? And she said, no, I don't think so. I said, I know, because I practiced so much that when I stepped on stage for an hour, it was clapping. That's how well I knew it. So when I get worried, I think of Allen Iverson, who's a basketball player who has a famous snippet on TV. Practice? Practice? This is only practice. Yes, life is practice to me. And I exchange the ego-based consciousness with practice. I tell myself when I have those needs, especially to worry or to be resentful, whoa, 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 I'm going to go back. I'm going to use that energy to practice. Because I know if I practice this, that I'm increasing my statistical success, my efficiency. I'm also utilizing the physics of the universe, the math of the universe of attention plus intention, right? Because now I'm practicing putting attention and giving intention by practicing what I think, say, do, believe, and understanding my personality traits, characteristics, obsessions, and addictions, practicing honing those towards what? The coincidences I want. Like you said, finding your soulmate, having a great speech instead of pooping your pants.
Yes. So I want to switch directions just a little bit. I know you have to go soon and I really appreciate and value your time. But one area that I would love for you to touch on, David, before you leave us today is family and learning how to set boundaries and cultivate healthier relationships with your family. A lot of people in this community have started to come to terms with, you know, still as an adult, just doing things for their parents and living life for their parents. I actually believe that it is really important to resolve things within your own family. And I know that you have like a really solid relationship with your mom and everything that you went through with your dad, you know, even though you know that they weren't perfect and they could have done things better, you've really forgiven. And there's a quote I heard recently because, you know, I made the decision to remove myself from my family unit completely to start healing, which I do think is necessary in some cases, but not everyone. And somebody said, oh, you think you're enlightened? Here's the real test. Now go back and hang out with your family who hasn't healed at all. And then you'll really know if you've truly like reached that point of enlightenment and whatnot. I thought it was really telling. I was like, man, that's so true. So even though there can be a lot of healing in setting, you know, more strict boundaries with family members like I did, it can also be an escape. You know, it can also be like the work is there and being able to go back and challenge yourself. So you guys probably heard in the beginning of this call, I think this is hilarious, but David says that his mom had this saying, or maybe it was a family saying, correct me, but it was either you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, or you're a failure. And those were the expectations that were put on him and his siblings. So how did you get through that? How did you sort of start to forge life on your own terms? Not just live for your parents and what they wanted for you, but at the same time, you've also forgiven them and you also love them so deeply and have this unconditional love for them, even if they did have a little bit of their own narcissistic parenting going on. Can you go into how you healed that? Because I know that's a big thing that affects a lot of people.
That's a great question. And I wish more people would ask, because I think number one, with any relationships, you know, relativity is so important and our parents are most relative to us, my wife, next, my kids. So, you know, understanding the relativity of relationships is important because you want to identify it on what I think is a feeding chain. And so I look at my family members and I ask myself, who's feeding me the most? So there's three categories. One, family members that feed me. within a spectrum. And those who feed me the most, I'm going to feed. And those who feed me less will get fed as well. And then there's a second category of those that don't feed me. They don't cause me any harm, but they're not feeding me. And I want to make sure that I'm utilizing my resources, et cetera, to make sure that those people are kept with boundaries, and some maybe even I allow to fall away from my life, because I want to maximize my energy and feed that energy to those people that are feeding me the energy I want. And then finally, the bleeding, which is so difficult, because many family members, especially member people that were forced to sit next to at work or work for or have them work for us, they bleed us. And you need to have a blend or a spectrum of firing those people that bleed you. You know, if it feeds you, feed it. If it doesn't, allow it to fall away in varying degrees. And then if it bleeds you, fire them from your life in varying degrees. Now, after you determine what category these people are in, then you can ask yourself, in those relationships that you want, even if they're bleeding you, how you can heal that. Forgiveness to me is the greatest healer. And there's only one person ever to forgive, which is yourself. I didn't tell the story about my father, but I realized I hated my father because he was a liar, cheater, back-end seller, overseller, manipulator. And I realized right before my wife was going to leave me, when I saw a jacket that he had given me to tell me that he had made these mistakes, that I was the liar, the cheater, the manipulator, overseller. It's quantum in my nature to be just like my father, and I hated myself. Once I healed self, I could forgive my father and put it into the context of where he fell in. And by the time he died by 80, my dad was feeding me. My dad was actually had shifted where he fed me so much wisdom and energy and all the things, because there was four things that I realized in a relationship, especially a parental relationship to a child, whether you're the parent or the child. Number one, no matter what they say, do, or believe, all a parent wants inherently in their quantum being is four things from their child. They may say other things because of conditions, quantum memories, ancestral memories, socioeconomic pressures they're under, insecurities that they're projecting onto you. But in the end, if you hold still on four things, number one, your parents want to know that you're healthy. Their ultimate inception of you is to make sure you stay alive. It's inherent in their being that you're healthy. They do not want to outlive you. It's their greatest fear. No matter how much you think they hate you and disappointed in you, and you need to let them know how healthy you are, and you'll start building that bond. Second thing, they want you to be happy. Even though they press upon you, you know, I have a saying, just because someone loves you doesn't mean they give you good advice. Just because your mom wants you to be a doctor or a lawyer and thinks that everybody else in the world is a failure, that's just a projection of all those things I previously mentioned. What they really want is you to be happy. The third thing that they want is to know unconditionally that you love them, that you love them unconditionally. And then the fourth thing that they need to know is that you appreciate them, that you add value and they add value to your life. Appreciation is adding value. And they want to know that symbiosis of value, of giving and receiving. And so for me, I actually, as part of one of my non-negotiables, what I call an adaptable routine, a non-negotiable in my life, healed my mom and my relationship. Because my mom was making me do all kinds of weird things. She would make me drive down to San Diego to fix a screen door. And I'm like, I'll just pay someone to go. No, no, I need you to do it. And I couldn't understand what was going on. It was because I wasn't satisfying the four things that she really needed. And so I started calling her a minimum of a minute a day. And I always start out and just tell her, hey, mom, before we start, I just want to tell you four things. I am so healthy. I am so happy. I love you so much and appreciate you. Now, what can I do for you? Oh, no, nothing. Oh, but, you know, the car registration sticker needs to put on the license plate, but I'll get my friend Mel to put that on for me. When before it was, I need the car sticker put on my license plate. Can you come down, drive an hour both ways to put the sticker on the license plate? I just can't do it. Why? Because I wasn't secure in the health, happiness, love, and appreciation. Once you're secure in that, it healed so much. And I healed that within myself and started forgiving myself for all the things that I wasn't, that I thought my mom wanted me to be. And once I realized what she wanted me to be, which was happy, healthy, appreciative, and loving, I could satisfy that quite easily.
Wow. Yeah, it's really insightful, especially almost like you could go on another direction in that where your mom had, she wasn't able to ask directly for what she needed either. It was like she subconsciously, her subconscious knew what she wanted, but she was going about getting it all these funky ways, which us women especially love to do, yeah. Right? Where we're like, wait, I need this. But it's like, what do you really need? What's underlying the whole thing?
Taking out the trash, you know, like people do it all the time. They'll get so upset that you forget to take the trash out, especially your wife. It's because it's displaying that you don't appreciate or love or respect. You know, it's like this little thing has nothing to do with the trash. Nothing to do with the trash. It's so when I started realizing I'm focusing on what I want from my wife, but also focusing in on what I want to and she wants from me. I mean, what are the things that make you feel loved by me? And if taking out the trash makes you feel love, you know, better than, you know, me dancing in my G-string, then I'll take out the trash. Probably a lot better looking in the trash anyway, but I don't blame her. But literally, people do this all the time. They get up in these offenses and resentment over these little things because they put meaning into everything we see. You put meaning in everything you see. So if you put meaning of love into washing the dishes and somebody doesn't wash the dishes, they don't love you. This is a huge problem, but rationally, we don't get it. And we're like, what a B word, you know, like I'm married to a queen. And that's my accountability to understand how not only do I treat her like a king, queen, but where I look for the queen in her. And then I end up, what, happily married in 23 years, married to a queen, more attracted and best friends, and just excited to get that. You know, one of the biggest gifts in my life is I'm one of the few people you'll meet that I am excited to go to the office and even more excited to go home.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode in any way or found any value, screenshot it, share it, however you like. My only ask is you help me empower others to be happy.